Support for The Full Story comes from Long Wharf Theater, creating theater of, for, and by the people of Greater New Haven. Everyone's story has a place at Long Wharf. You belong.
Once again, we have a number of guests on The Full Story today talking about the pandemic. And in a moment, I'm going to tell you how you can get your questions to them. Welcome, everyone. Thanks, as always, for being part of our program. I'm Ron Ropiak. Whether it's in its own small way, whether it's The Full Story or something else, programs like this, I believe, are more important than ever because they help keep a community together. And I've noticed that online websites such as Nextdoor, just to pick one, they're extremely popular now, and which is excellent because we're all going to need a way to stay connected over the next few months. With that in mind, here's how you can connect with our guest today. We have a Facebook page, Full Story WSHU. You can leave a comment there, or you can email us at tfs@wshu.org. We're going to connect now with Steve Israel. He was in Congress for 8 terms, I believe, representing New York's 3rd District. Welcome back, sir.
Ron, thanks for having me on. Thanks for what you're doing to keep us all informed.
It's our pleasure. When you were in Congress, were there any warnings that something like this may happen one day?
Actually, yes. I participated in 2 tabletop simulations, war games, at the National Defense University. In both cases, the premise, the simulation, was a pandemic. In both cases, we anticipated many of the real-time, real-life challenges that are playing out today. So we did have lessons learned. We had these simulations. What I think was really and has been a major reason for our inconsistent response in real time has been that the administration dismantled the Global Health Security and Biodefense Office at the National Security Council. I remember in our war games, we had folks in the National Security Establishment who did have a very strong expertise in how you deal with global pandemic. Those people were at the table when we did these war games, but they were not at the White House when they were needed to deal with coronavirus.
How far back did you do these war games?
Well, those war games were done. I was a member of the House Armed Services Committee initially, so they were done, I would say, around 2004 through 2006. The budget for the National Defense University, by the way, has been slashed, and so to my knowledge, those war games are no longer offered for members of Congress. Ron, they were so important because we were able, as members of Congress, to understand the immediate decisions that have to be made, the judgments that have to be made, the whole of government principle where you bring everybody in and sit at a table and deal with fast-breaking challenges. And now we are seeing this play out in real life, and many of the experts, as I said, who guided members of Congress in this practical exercise have not been available when we needed them because of these ludicrous budget cuts to CDC and the very dangerous decision to dismantle President Obama's Office of Public Health Security, Global Health Security, and Biodefense.
Congressman, what are the 2 biggest mistakes being made on the federal level today? What do they need to fix today?
Well, this has been a response that has been confused, inconsistent, and catch up. And so I think that they are now finally, the administration is now finally catching up with the gravity of the situation. The 2 big mistakes were, number one, trying to play this down. For 2 months, when we knew that this was happening in China, the President of the United States telling people, we've got this, it's under control, disregarding his own experts, acting frivolously towards the crisis, showing up at a CDC press conference on March 7th in a Keep America Great campaign hat. So underplaying this, treating it not as the threat it was the first big mistake. Second was the inconsistency, saying one thing, then having to reverse it, telling people, go to work, as the president did, and the next day saying, no, don't go to work. What's happened now is I think a lot of that initial confusion and inconsistency has started to abate, largely as a result of the lesson that President Trump has learned, which is listen to your experts. Listen to Dr. Fauci. Listen to the folks at CDC. Let them drive the response and show the leadership you need, but have people who are informed and experienced address this. And I believe that that's what is happening now.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Steve Israel. He's a former congressman from Long Island. Talk to us about getting the economy going again. The news is coming in rapidly. It's probably going to be over $1 trillion, I'm guessing, in stimulus. What else should be done?
Well, this is a very fluid situation. I was in Congress, as you said, for 16 years, including serving in the leadership of the House Democrats. I've never seen an economic situation as fluid as it is, except for one moment, and that was when the economy collapsed in 2008, when the Bush administration, was proposing a series of actions, and Congress was trying to react as quickly as possible. So now, today, you have the administration proposing an $850 billion stimulus. A good part of that could be cash payments to individual Americans. Secretary Mnuchin is in talks with Senate Republicans on that right now, so that everybody essentially would get a check to help stimulate the economy. And then there would be some support and assistance for the airline industry and other affected industries. That's on top of a $100 billion supplemental appropriations bill that the House passed just last week that provides paid sick leave, free corona testing, paid family and medical leave, and strengthens unemployment and expands Medicaid. That bill was held up in the House of Representatives by one Republican Congressman, Louis Gohmert. He removed his objection. It should be voted on imminently by the Senate. There is some opposition in the Senate to that $100 billion economic relief bill, and we'll have to see what happens. And then finally, that $100 billion is on top of an $8.3 billion bill that was passed 2 weeks ago that provides direct support for the FDA, CDC, NIH, and other public health entities.
So comes out to around $1 trillion, right?
You are right, sir, about $1 trillion, and we'll have to see whether that's sufficient in the long run. I think our economy is going to be rattled as severely as it was in 2008. We're going to have to learn from the mistakes we made then to avoid making them again.
So what's life going to be like in the future? Is it going to be a life with borders shut tight, immigration restrictions? I'm thinking, will there be mandatory health screenings, mandatory vaccinations? Will this become Fortress USA?
I rely on entities like the CDC to drive the policy on things like that. I mean, right now, we are playing catch up. We're looking at the experience that Italy had, that China had, that other countries have had. I think if you look at South Korea, for example, that's a very good example of a country that was prepared, consistent, straightforward. They set up drive-through testing. To this point, their ability to monitor infections, quarantine people without having to take draconian steps, I think, is a model that we should look at. It's hard to predict exactly how far we're going to have to go. Right now, the most important thing is what you have heard over and over, and what you yourself have reported, Ron, and that is social distancing, quarantining. I myself learned 2 days ago that I was exposed to, ironically, a Republican candidate for Congress who insisted on shaking my hands.
Nice.
Shook his hands and then learned that he had the virus. I'm self-quarantining. Those practical steps, are the most effective steps that we can take. And if we have to go further, I don't want the decisions to be political. I want them to be based on the expertise of the public health experts and leaders at places like the CDC.
Yeah, here at the station, we're all doing the elbow bump nowadays. With the two minutes that we have left,
sure.
This is going to pass one day. Unfortunately, many are going to suffer and die in the next few months. But there are those who say we have to start planning for the future. So with that in mind, what should we plan for? I mean, what will the biggest challenges be?
Well, I think two things. One, economic, the other in terms of public health. On the economy, I think we have to begin a conversation now on how we're going to repair the long-term damage to the economy. And I can tell you that a group of my former colleagues and I and others are talking about a major infrastructure investment in this country. Because even, you know, a $1,000 check that, you know, Americans may receive, it'll get us through the next few months, but what's going to get us through the next few years? And so I think Congress and the administration now have to put the rancor aside, pass a major investment in infrastructure to get people back to work, improve our infrastructure, our bridges, our tunnels, but also improve our public health infrastructure, which leads to the fact that we're going to have to learn lessons from other countries and begin to plan how you surge immediately in terms of hospitals, ventilators, respirators, help industry make sure that they have the appropriate face masks. Those are things that we're going to have to deploy much faster in the future, and we can learn the lessons today that will avoid a repeat of what's happened in the future.
And then maybe as part of that infrastructure plan, turn things around a little bit so that way we could deal with the climate change as part of that, which would be nice.
Well, that has to be a major part of it. Absolutely.
Fantastic. I got 20 seconds for final thoughts. What would you like to leave the audience with, please?
Well, this is a frightening time. We all know that. But we are resilient. We will get through this. There are practical steps people should take. And then we should be thinking about what the future holds for us. I'm confident we're going to come out of this within the next several months and maybe even come out of it more prepared and better for the future.
Steve Israel is a former congressman from Long Island. Be safe, sir. Be well.
You too.
Thank you.
Okay.
I appreciate
Bye-bye.
It. If you would like to comment on today's program, if you have questions for us, for the guests, you can email us. We're at tfs@wshu.org. And on Facebook, you can find us at Full Story WSHU. And as always, if you missed part of the program today and if you want to stream it, go to wshu.org. And if you go online, we are available as a podcast. And you can download the full story on Google Play, on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. We'll take our first break. We'll be right back. It's the full story on WSHU. A reminder, our program is live between 1 and 2 o'clock. It gets played back between 7 and 8. The news is evolving rapidly nowadays. For all the latest information, please go to WSHU.org. You're going to find all the latest information, what's happening in Connecticut and New York. And you're going to find links, directions to the different federal agencies and the state agencies. And obviously, they have all the details about preventions and precautions. So once again, WSHU.org. Joe McGee is with us now. Joe's the former Economic Development Commissioner for Connecticut, and he's a vice president over at the Fairfield County Business Council. Happy St. Patrick's Day to you, Mr. McGee.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you.
I haven't heard that from anybody today. That seems to have gotten a bit buried with everything that's going on.
No, it seems I've gotten lost in the midst of the gloom.
Yeah.
But anyway, happy St. Patrick's Day.
Same to you. And Professor Martin Cantor is with us. He is the director of the Long Island Center for Socioeconomic Policy, and he's the former Economic Development Commissioner for Suffolk County. Hey, Professor.
How are you?
Getting there. it's a strange question nowadays, isn't it?
Well, the answer changes almost every minute, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, whether information comes from Washington or Connecticut or New York, things change. You know, people are trying to do things, so things look better or worse, every second.
You gentlemen have worked with members of the region's business community for decades. What's your message to them going forward? Joe, I'd like to start with you.
Well, it's interesting. We had a meeting yesterday. You know, it's funny how people respond to a crisis like this. We had 100 companies in the chat room yesterday, Monday, talking about their experience. And it was extremely valuable what each company is doing, how they're handling this. And it's funny. It's the private sector is kind of working out its way of handling this. And the solutions from company to company are very different. So it's been very valuable to share kind of what companies, large companies to small companies, are doing. But the need for information that you can trust is the critical issue. You know, who are the trusted sources of information? That's become very important to understand.
So I have to tell you something, Joe, and also Professor. On the way in, our producer, J.D. Allen, is working on Long Island today, and he and I were discussing Thursday's show. And I said, on Thursday's show, I would like half of it to be about trust nowadays, because I think a lot of people simply are not trusting the information that they're getting, whether it's from the federal government, from the CDC. It doesn't matter. People are doing what they're doing. And so, Professor, can you pick up on that in terms of who do we trust nowadays? Who does the business community trust?
Well, you know, my observation is, in this particular crisis, stop the politics. You know, that's what really bothers me. I'm a Democrat, you know, and I can't stand hearing Chuck Schumer beating up on Trump, when at this particular point in time, we ought to be saying, what can we do for the American people and what can we do for businesses, and leave the darn election, you know, until after, you know, we resolve this whole thing with Corona. But that doesn't seem to be the case. And that ties right into the trust issue. If all political people are going to do is see how they can get Trump out, then it really hurts the trust of the business people, because that's all they – business people are pretty pragmatic, and they see the challenge, and they see the problem, and they take out their budgets, and they take a look, and they deal with it. And it doesn't matter what political party they are. They're capitalists, and they deal with it. So let's start dealing with the information and stop the politics and talk about what the facts are, and wipe away all this stuff and find out where's the cash coming from. Because right now, the short-term damage will be on the fact that people who normally would spend discretionary income in the marketplace are not spending it. And the restaurants and the entertainment venues and things like that are going to suffer. And some of them, and I heard a statistic today, 30% might not come back after, you know, and will be damaged. And if you're dealing in necessities, you're going to do fine, because people will spend money on the necessities. So with all that having been said, the question of how people react is trust. People, the panic factor, and it's really interesting, in economics, there really is a theory on lemmings into the sea, the irrationality of people. And when people are afraid, that means they don't really believe or trust the information they're getting, and they're taking it upon themselves to do what they think is right for their own preservation. And that's why we have tons of toilet paper being taken off the shelves. Why toilet paper? I don't know. But all paper goods, or frozen goods, or canned goods, because they don't trust what people are telling them as to how long this will be, and whether they'll have to be spent 14 days in self-quarantine or more. And that's what's happening. We're not getting that type of information, which is really fanning fear, which is fanning how people are behaving.
So, Joe, last week, before this really started to take off, I was speaking with a friend of mine who's a pretty well-known business leader, and he and I were discussing what to do, and he said, and I told him one of my ideas, and he said, good for you. He goes, work the problem. And he goes, that's what we're falling. He goes, I meet so many people nowadays who, like the professor was saying, he believed that they were acting irrationally. And he said, take a deep breath, work the problem. So what I want to know is, in that chat room that you were doing, how are they approaching that? What are the problems that they're working on?
Well, you know, the big one was social isolation. That people working at home, and now, you know, 80% of our companies, their workers are now working from home. And one of the things they're concerned about is just you're isolated. So how do they begin introducing some sort of connection to people so they're not just feeling isolated and scared at home? Which I thought was really interesting. I had not thought of that initially as a major issue. But I think companies are beginning to, okay, this is the new world we're living in. This is a short-term problem. Short-term, maybe 3 to 5 months. It's very bad, but we're going to get through this. So how do we plan to do, Zoom? How do we connect, like working at home? What's the software? And I'm telling you, people adapt to it pretty quickly. Our office just had a 2.5-hour Zoom meeting, which I never thought was going to work well, and it worked perfectly. So we were all 10 of us in different locations, all looking at the same program and working. So it does work. But it's going to take time, And I go back to what the professor said, what Marty said. Yeah, the politics, you got to get the politics out of this. This is not the time to be blaming, pointing fingers at this one or that one. This is just, okay, here's what's going on. Let's get the information out there, and we can deal with it. So I think companies, you're seeing them doing that, and they're working that problem, I think, very effectively.
You know, Professor, Joe brings up, I think, such an interesting point because, so my kid, like many other kids, had to come home from college. And so I said, look, for the next few weeks, you're going to have to be home. You're going to have to be online with your friends. I really don't want you seeing anybody. Mom and I don't want to get sick. It was pretty easy. And I said, does that bother you? And he just kind of shrugged his shoulders because doing Zoom, chatting online, texting and all that, that's second nature to the new generation. It's not that big of a deal for them. To be honest, I just think it's maybe those who are a little bit older who are going to struggle with this.
Well, you know, I have to tell you, Ron, that I've been doing that kind of teleconferencing, if you will, using Skype or Zoom for years. With my clients, whether they be accounting or economic consulting work, they're not always in the same place at the same time, but they can always be somewhere at the same time and use technology. And I think it's great. It's efficient. It keeps you from traveling from location to location. You get more billing time or more productivity out of your workday. But I agree with you. One of the interesting things, when I took my doctoral program and we learned all this new technology, one good thing was I realized that I was a dinosaur, you know, growing up with the 80s and 90s and stuff, and the 70s, and we didn't have this stuff. And a lot of my contemporaries are still dinosaurs because like Joe said, it's a new thing to them, so it's really dragging people kicking and screaming into the new world, the new technology, and those companies that can adapt and work the problem are going to do well, not do well, but they're going to survive this crisis. Those who don't do the adapt are going to have a tough time.
I agree with that.
With about the 8 minutes that we have left, since you were the former Economic Development Commissioner for Connecticut, and Professor, since you were the former Economic Development Commissioner for Suffolk County, I would like to get your perspective on what each state, Connecticut and New York, should be doing to help the business community. Joe, if you were with Governor Lamont right now, what would you tell him?
Well, I think the SBA program, the new disaster relief, it's $2 million long-term loan. That's going to be really important, but there's going to be an enormous volume of people applying. So what I'm a little bit concerned about is how do you handle the volume of small business loans that are going to have to be processed in a short period of time? Because right now, if you look at restaurants and bars and anything like that, they have no cash flow. So they're going to be under tremendous pressure, and we have got to adjust so that they can get cash in their pocket quick to pay their bills. I think the other issue is if you look at home health care workers, there's a whole group of people out there who are going to have a big loss of income. I thought Senator Romney's idea of just sending people $1,000 just to tide them over is not a bad idea. I mean, this thing is, it's going to be around for a while, but it's not going to be around forever. So we've got to move very aggressively in the short run to make certain we're not putting all these people out of business. And I think that's critically the ability to get credit quickly from the banks and from the SBA and the state of Connecticut.
Professor Cantor?
I agree with that. I also like what the president said today was the April 15th is still the filing deadline, but he's giving 90 days for those people who owe money to take their time to accumulate the cash. Right now, for business, the cash is king. If you don't have cash in the bank, and I always tell my clients, have at least 6 months worth of operating expense in the bank because you never know when you're going to need it. Well, a lot of these small businesses don't have that. And that's going to be a big problem. And if the small businesses close down, and on Long Island, that's 90% of our business base is small business. That's with 10 fewer employees. That means you're going to have people who are hourly workers out of work also. So what I would say also, if I was the governor of New York, who I think is doing a pretty good job, he's got to be saying unemployment insurance. you know, waive the waiting period, which he's mentioned, get cash into people's pockets, because that's the one thing that's going to save the economy from recession, is putting cash in people's pockets and giving them the comfort level that they can go out and spend it. If that doesn't happen, then we're in for a tough road to hoe the next 4 to 6 months.
Joe, go ahead.
I agree completely with that, and I think getting cash into people's hands quickly is going to be critical. The old slow bureaucracy is not going to work here. You've got to move very, very quickly in the next, you know, week or two.
Joe, I've been thinking a lot about the future, and I know it's a strange thing because so much is going on right now, but I'm wondering, in the future, are we looking at a whole new paradigm? I mean, is this going to become Fortress USA? Will travel be restricted? Will we have mandatory vaccinations? I mean, have you thought about that?
Well, clearly, I mean, you know, we had this whole vaccination fight at the state legislature about people who don't want their kids vaccinated. I mean, clearly, medical science is going to drive a lot of this. We're going to have to really be far more aggressive in the money we spend to do research, because you can't afford to have these things. You know, this is hopefully a once in 100-year situation. It can't be once every 10 years. And that's going to be really critical. And I think that is a World Health Organization issue. I think a lot of money is going to have to go into medical research.
Yeah, and I think, and you're absolutely right, Joe. I also think that, no, we're not going to be Fortress USA. Just like China is not going to be Fortress China, and Egypt, which I just came back from in December, is going to be Fortress Egypt. They had 12 cases of the coronavirus that they're telling people. The point is that we are a global economy, and we cannot survive going back to the days of George Washington, beware of foreign entanglements. We're entangled up to our yin-yang in terms of international trade and global economy, and we can't survive. We, for the first time in a long time, the U.S. balance of deficit trade and oil was on our favor. So and we're exporting a lot more goods than we used to. So we cannot survive as an insulated society, the United States. We need a global economy, and so does Europe, for that matter, and so does China. If China closes its doors, it exports a lot of technology and pharmaceuticals to America. It needs a foreign economy and foreign tourism. You know, I was in China last May. I mean, you know, you've got to be able to have that, you know, to keep, Xi Jinping understands that if he can't keep his people working, he's got a major problem of revolt on his hands. And so he needs the money coming in. No, we're going to go back to a global economy, and I think the medical profession, as Joe says, they're going to come up with this. You know, there's rumors that Israel has a solution they've been developing. We have other places that are developing solutions to the coronavirus. We're going to find this. We're going to have a vaccine, and we're going to go back to normal eventually. It might be slightly a different new normal, but it's going to be like the old. It's going to be the old way, because you just need it. Maybe we'll pay more attention to people getting on planes, and besides frisking people, maybe they'll take people's temperature to see if they're well. They'll pay more attention to the health on airplanes, which we know is very fragile for the flying public. And but I think things will go back to the way they used to be.
Yes, and just as an example, I remember the polio crisis. I mean, I'm old enough to remember that, and that was really scary. And then Saul came up with a vaccination, and, you know, we've just pretty much wiped out polio. So I think medical science is critical in this, but the research that's going to have to go into this is going to be extensive, and because we don't want to be putting up with this again.
Well, I agree. You know, and the last thing, I mean, the politicians have to draw, you know, they just have to back off. We understand politics and what happens. And it's interesting, George Washington was against political parties. He thought everybody should be as an American and just go that way. And look what's happening. We're spending more time on stupid politics as to who's to blame for this thing than we are, you know, focusing how to work it through. And you're right, Joe. Work the problem. You know, leave the politics at the entrance to the door.
I agree with that.
You know what? I only have a minute left, so I'm going to give you 30 seconds each for final thoughts. Joe, can I start with you, please?
Well, I would say it is scary. There's no question of that. But at the same time, we have to remember now, we'll get through this. It could be 3 months. It could be 5 months. But just like with polio, and you got to remember that, because that was a terrible scourge, we got through it, and we'll get through this.
Professor Cantor, final thoughts, please.
Yeah, it'll take time to get through this. Medical science will rise to the occasion like it always does. It is an important lesson to learn. you know, in terms of how fragile, you know, our quality of life is. But it'll take time. The most important thing I could say is people have to pay attention and say if it's a 14-day quarantine, then do it. To solve this thing, people have to isolate themselves and make sure it doesn't get spread. Because if you stop the spreading, then this thing will end sooner than later.
Professor Martin Kanter, director of the Long Island Center for Socioeconomic Policy. He's the former Economic Development Commissioner for Suffolk County. And Joe McGee. Joe's the former Economic Development Commissioner for Connecticut. And he's vice president over at the Fairfield County Business Council. You gentlemen have always been excellent friends to this program, and I thank you for that. I hope that you both stay very safe, and I hope you're well, and we'll speak soon.
Always a pleasure, thank Joe, God. To speak with you. And Ron, you too. Stay well.
Thank you.
Take care, Marty. Bye-bye.
Thank you. And the program is going to continue right after the break, and I want to tell you that you heard what the professor and Joe had to say. Be positive. But in the meantime, so many have anxieties and stress over that. We are going to be talking about that when we come back from our break. Please stay with us. The other day, I was reading how sales at area wine and liquor stores were booming. And up in Massachusetts, many were hitting the local marijuana stores, stocking up in case a total shutdown is enacted. That is how some are coping with the anxieties and fears that we all have. The rest of us have to do it the old-fashioned way, whatever that is. Dr. Jeffrey Dietz is with us. He's assistant professor at the Frank Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, and he has his own psychiatry practice in Fairfield, Connecticut. Hi, Doc. How are you?
Good afternoon, Ron. Good afternoon, everybody.
Mitchell Scher is also with us. He is professor of psychology at Hofstra University. Professor, how are you?
I'm doing fine. Happy to be here.
Thank you for coming on. We appreciate your time. Dr. Dietz, you've been with us a number of times in the past. It's always a pleasure to have you on the program. What are people telling you nowadays?
They're scared. That's what they're telling me. I think, well, first off, there's a reason to be scared, so let's not say people are making this up, okay? However, as I talk to people, family, and my patients, I'm picking up some things particular about their fear right now, and it really is about the unknown, okay? There is so much that is known about this particular virus. I've been reviewing the biology of this, and virologists have been studying viruses like this for long, long period of time. The scientists are not starting from scratch when they try to understand how to interrupt this virus.
Hey, doctor, I'm going to interrupt you for 1 second because you're kind of fading in and out with your phone, so I'll tell you what to do. Hang up. Terry's going to call you right back. We'll get you back on, and we'll let you then continue the thought. He has the other number that he's going to call you. So just give a quick hang up, and I'll speak with Professor Scher for a minute, and then we'll get to you if that's all right.
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, thanks. Professor Scher, thanks for staying with us. What are your patients telling you? Or do you have patients?
Yes.
Okay.
I run a clinic at the university for phobias and trauma work. We're dealing with anxiety disorders all the time, and I see some private patients as well. So patients are basically scared. They're fearful. They're anxious. And as Dr. Dietz was saying, the unknown is part of it. You know, we have not been in a situation like this before. And you have to think about ourselves as Americans for a moment. As Americans, we like to go. We can get in our cars and go. We can go to bars. We can go shopping. We can get on airplanes. And basically, everything that we consider to be so normal and so typical suddenly has stopped, and stopped in a very quick period of time. So all of this is contributing to the fears that people have now. People who have anxieties, it exacerbates. People who didn't have fear or anxiety now are having it. So it's a time of the unknown and a time, again, for many, many people to have these concerns.
Okay, so before I bring Dr. Dietz back in, what are you recommending them to do? For some, is it medication? Others, is it meditation, exercise, walking in the woods? I mean, what do we do?
Well, before we get into specific activities, I think attitude has to be considered first. People who feel fear think that this is a scary, bad thing. But from an evolutionary perspective, fear is actually good. Fear makes us aware. It keeps us safe. It keeps us alive. And so I'm suggesting that if we start thinking like, oh, I'm scared that when I go out, I might do something inappropriate, that means we're now more conscious of our behavior. So fear in and of itself, anxiety in and of itself, is not necessarily a bad thing if we take it and sort of convert our thinking into actions that actually keep us safe and remind us of how we need to behave in a more helpful way.
Okay. Okay.
Different change, right? Different attitude.
It's basically using the bad for good.
That's correct. And so there's a lot of things that people can do, and it really depends on the situations. I think, you know, first of all, being confined to one's house, in and about one's house, one's apartment, etc., this seems difficult to people. It's like, oh my God, I'm going to be in my house for weeks? Who knows? We don't know how long. But it's very important, first of all, that people establish a normal routine, a daily routine. It has to be important. That means get up, get out of bed, wash as you would, dress as you would, eat on a schedule or more normally, because that's important, because life is continuing and it's going on. And I think what people need to do is to utilize the time at home in some very, very useful ways. Find activities and projects that you keep on putting off. You can do them now. Organize those stack of photos if you wanted to. Read the book you've been putting off. Working on some work project that you might have to write. Whatever it is, using the time that you have is important to do, and use it in a functional way. It could be cleaning. It could be painting. Whatever it is that you would do. But I also think it's very important that when you stay home, you do not socially isolate. And that would be a mistake here. We need to physically isolate, right? This is going to reduce the spread of the virus. But socially, we still need to be the social creatures we normally are. We need to call people, text people, video chat with people. We need to reach out in the appropriate ways that we make contact and keep in contact with people around us. So that's very important stuff, particularly around the house. Now, I have other suggestions, but I don't want to continue.
Well, let me bring Dr. Dietz back in because he's very
absolutely
patient, and I didn't have a chance to chat with him before, but we have a good phone connection now. Doc, let me ask you about those reports that I'm reading that sales are up at wine and liquor stores, and that people, it wasn't so much about Connecticut and New York, but obviously about Massachusetts and people going into the marijuana stores and hoarding, if you will, because they're anticipating they'll be locked down for a while. That must, as a psychiatrist, what's your reaction when you hear that?
Well, I want to expand on what the doctor was just saying, because I think this is part of that. One might call something like that an adaptive reaction, but sometimes adaptations get out of hand. So, of course, storing up is good. Hoarding is an overreaction. But the idea of adapting to a crisis by thinking through and planning for the future does make sense. Getting a handle so that an adaptive response, and this I'd like to pick up a little bit on what the other doctor was saying. Yes, fear can promote adaptive responses. And in my experience, the best coping, or making the best out of a bad situation, is the best coping one can do. So that would be where, of course, if you read something or if you worked on a project at home, that would be adaptive. Now, in terms of liquor sales, Are we seeing that as people trying to use it for anti-anxiety purposes, that is in self-medication, or are people figuring, like, I'm not going to go out to a bar because I've been told they're closed, so I'll get my supply at home and have a smaller gathering? I want to know more about, and I think more needs to be understood about the behavior. But to the extent that the public health initiatives have gotten people to reconsider the way they're socializing, in a time like this where social distancing is the critical factor that we can do to slow down the spread, then I would say that's an adaptive response. Of course, it would be going too far if people maladaptively used alcohol in a way that harmed their ability to socialize or to cope. So let's stay informed and let's keep people aware of how to react healthfully. I think that's part of the mental health professionals' world.
Professor Scher, someone told me the other day that they went to the store and there was an elderly couple standing outside and they were crying because they were afraid to go in. Now, just hearing this broke my heart. But this person, good for him, he got them back to their car and he went shopping for them. The fear, the anxiety that so many have nowadays on so many levels is overwhelming. But it's I think it goes back to what you were saying. Now is the time to act like human beings, do the right thing.
Yes, it's without a doubt. We are still social creatures, and we have to behave as an orderly society. So as Dr. Dietz said, yes, people have gone and hoarded. You know, they've hoarded tons of stuff well beyond their needs to make them feel safer. But the problem is, in society, we still need to leave our houses. So despite the notion of we want to confine and socially distance from people, we still do have to go out. We still need to go to supermarkets and buy goods. So these poor people may have been, to some degree, scared, not knowledgeable of what it would be like to go into a supermarket where there are other people around. So we have to sort of talk about this a little more behaviorally. So what can we do in those kinds of situations? Well, one of the things I'm suggesting to people is a good behavioral reminder that the world outside isn't so safe when it comes to the coronavirus is to wear disposable gloves. Hopefully those all haven't been hoarded. And by putting on a glove, you wear a glove, and it reminds you immediately that, oh, when I'm shopping, when I'm touching stuff, I have a glove on. That's a weird thing. It's not my typical way of operating. Furthermore, the glove will also be a symbol not to touch your face, not to put food into your mouth, not to do the normal human behaviors that we would do on any given day. It's a representation that when we take the glove off, when we're back home or when we're going to eat food, we take the glove off and then we wash or sterilize our hands if we have any of that rare sanitizer. So the point is, we can still behave in ways that are normative, that we need to do, but if we go to a supermarket, then we go home. We keep a distance from people. We're not close talking, as the old Seinfeld episode would imply. What we want to do is keep a reasonable distance from people. If anyone is coughing, sneezing, turn away. Just immediately turn your face away, because that is one of the ways that we could potentially get infected. So using some practical behavioral little tricks to keep ourselves safe in social distancing, I think, is very important. And my heart goes out for this older couple, and I would say anyone who is a younger, healthy person, who is a little more comfortable going out, turn to your neighbors. Turn to your elderly family, whoever it is, and offer to help them. That would be a great thing to do.
I love the Close Talker episode. I don't want to be a pirate.
can I say something?
Sure, but I have a question for you from a listener, which is kind of strange, but I think it fits into what we're talking about. The last time that you were on the program, I asked you a question as to which was a little weird. And you looked at me and you just kind of laughed and you said, Ronnie, you want me to explain to you why humans act irrationally, which made me laugh. So my question is, and this comes from the listeners, you talk about hoarding and why we act and do certain things. Why do we hoard toilet paper?
That's a very good question. I suppose that's a multi-determined phenomenon. Hygiene. I suppose it's hygiene. Can I say a word, a little bit about the biology? Because I really want people to chill with respect to the biology of this thing. First off, understand the food supply is not contaminated. You're not going to get this virus by eating something. Thank God. Okay? It is not airborne. It exists in droplets that people cough and sneeze out, which get on surfaces. So if you touch a surface and then touch your face and breathe it in, that's how it's transmitted, unless you're breathing in particles that other people are exhaling. Which is why you don't go to large sporting events, because people yell and scream and they exhale particles while they're rooting for their team in close quarters. But that those pictures that we keep seeing on television over and over of the spheres with the little spikes sticking out, I want people to understand that those spheres are covered with a soap-like material. They dissolve on contact with soap and water. Washing your hands, if you get it on your hands and you wash your hands, you will dissolve this stuff. So think about this. In terms of going outside, it's not in the air unless somebody within your airspace breathes out a droplet that you inhale. I understand stores, and I'm so grateful to hear that Stop and Shop is going to let seniors come in a little bit early. But practicing safe hygiene and being careful about what you touch on the surfaces and then what you inhale is a tremendous protector. Of course, as the doctor says, you don't want to be around somebody that's coughing because the particles you may inhale. But by keeping that safe distance and then making sure, whether it's overkill or not, to wash your hands after you've touched a foreign surface, you will kill this thing. And what we're doing now is what can be done to keep the spread down. I know it's a concept that's hard to wrap one's head around. However, looking at the evidence from the, the Chinese place, we saw that there is a peak and then there is a diminution. We don't know yet, because we're doing the containment that we can, how long the exposure risk will go on. But as long as people wrap their heads around the idea that they can protect themselves and their family safely, I think that will reduce panic. And I want to say one more thing to ask people to do, because I'm a psychiatrist, but I do follow the science literature. There are really informative websites that people can go to. They can stay off the television stations, which overemphasize the doom and gloom here. It's news, and I understand worst-case scenarios are being presented. But I'm going to tell your leader, your audience.
And Dr. Dietz, I only have 20 seconds left, so do it quickly, please.
Ars Technica, ArsTechnica.com science. You'll get the latest, and you will feel encouraged to see what the scientific community is doing.
Dr. Jeffrey Dietz, it's Ars Technica. Dr. Jeffrey Dietz, assistant professor of the Frank Natter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University. Mitchell Scher, professor of psychology at Hofstra University. Gentlemen, both of you, you're the best. Thank you. I appreciate you coming on.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
It's going to do it for our show today. Joelle Sears, our engineer. Carrie Franks, the digital editor. Our associate producers, Fatu Sangari, Sabrina Garone, Roberto Rojas, Desiree DiOrio. J.D. Allen is the producer, and Terry Sheridan is our line producer and our news director. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks to you for being part of The Full Story.